right. I think that's our cue to talk. Let's just leave that there. It's fine. And rebels are reasonable is one of the enigmatic placard slogans of Peter Fend. I wonder, Ken, if transforming her mode from projecting redacted, declassified documents on civic buildings and moving into oil on canvas, is this a sign of Jenny Holzer, the rebel, becoming reasonable?
So we're talking about Jenny's work.
Yes.
For this segment.
Well, I quoted Peter Fend because the slogan seemed interesting, and I'm trying to apply it now to Jenny Holzer. Do you think is the rebel becoming reasonable by painting rather than projecting onto buildings?
Well, I don't know if painting is ever a reasonable thing. I don't know. I guess looking at the show, I felt like it put me in this contradictory state without resolution, where you have this kind of nicely made oil on canvas work, and then you have this verbal content that's kind of horrifying, and if you take it seriously, it makes you think, I shouldn't even be here in a gallery looking at these things. I should be out doing something more productive, more humanistically productive. So I don't really know how to resolve that. And I'm not sure if that's what she intends.
Do you have a clearer idea? Well, Marjorie, would you have a clearer idea of what she intends? And do you find this, is her intention in a way to explore that kind of tension between activism and contemplation that Ken is identifying?
Yes, I could make sense of her intentions, which are quite obvious. The LED for technologies for which she is best known are so fortuitous in their delivery system of agitprop that by comparison, canvases, which after all are embedded in histories of painting, are confusing. That's one answer. Another answer is her intention would seem to be whether to import what people called content, but I think that's a term that has to be interrogated, into painting to rally people who would be looking at painting to certain kinds of social activism or at least social consciousness. Advantageous to her in this show is that instead of scanning the messages, which we who know her work would do if she were silk screening, we have to decode the messages word by word, if not letter by letter. So she slows us down. The disadvantage to her is that by doing formalist painting, we see the deficit between her own work and some of the masters. The surfaces are delicate, even finicky, and do not hold up in comparison with color field painting to which she is referring.
Right. So, Joan, once upon a time, the young Holzer would go out and wheat paste, put truisms in various colors around places. Now now that she has the masses completely behind her, it's time to catch that last echelon of the bourgeoisie and show us paintings instead. Do you buy that theory?
Not really, no.
Ah, okay.
But I do remember those days when she was pasting the posters all over the telephone poles and light poles in Lower Manhattan. But I would have maybe a little bit different means of approaching what she's doing here as a critic. You know, I'm looking at this work and I'm thinking about how I'm gonna devise a set of terms that I could use to level a critique against it. And I found, of all the shows that I looked at, Holzer was actually the most compelling in this regard. The first point I came to is that usually, I mean, when looking at paintings, you're either going for the experience that the work generates or you're going for the kind of discourse that the work generates. I mean, this is just one possible dialectic. And in Holzer's work, I found myself really amazed at her ability to generate a discourse about a political subject in a way that was non-sensational and that allowed me, as I looked at those paintings, to reflect on my own culpability and responsibility as a U.S. taxpayer in relationship to the kind of information that I was getting through the text on the paintings. And I know a lot of people have said that these paintings are really beautiful and critique them in a way on that level, but I'd be inclined to agree with Marjorie that she really reveals her lack of mastery in painting when she goes for this. But what's really interesting to me is how well that works to her advantage. Because in looking at those paintings initially, the formal aspects of them are impenetrable. The brushstrokes are hesitant, finicky, anxiety-ridden. They're not embedded with an intention in the way, say, just for a quick example, the Joan Mitchell paintings that were on view in that same gallery recently are embedded with an incredible intention that a viewer could read. And I don't find Holzer's lines to be embedded with this kind of intention. And because they're so flat, they push you out and they throw you back on yourself. And to me, this was a really incredible device and in a way, kind of formal invention that she created to allow the person who's looking at her paintings to really think about their own position in relationship to her subject.
Yeah, I'm sort of flummoxed by them as paintings. They do not work as paintings, and they're a bizarre, for me, means of conveying the information that she finds compelling, and but it seems to me that also a letdown because the projections were so on the money. They were so classy and clever, and really opened many people's eyes, including my own, to the abundance of literature that literature documentation of. The subject that she's concerned with, and that we should all be concerned with. So it seems almost a caricature of herself to me to move from a brilliant strategy for dealing with that one body of evidence to then fetishizing and commodifying them into really awful paintings. Why not stick with the agenda, but find some other source of information and some other mode of conveyance. I'd almost compare them with Damien Hirst's paintings as a catastrophe, really, as painting and also as being what she can do well. Ken, is that harsh?
Oh, I guess. There's one part, John used the word impenetrable. The paintings she's done that interest me quite a bit are the ones where she's covered up the text with blocks of the text of these redacted documents with blocks of color, so they look like Russian constructivist paintings or something. And And it made me think about that the operative term for those is transparency, and in a way her whole project, which has to do with downloading information that's been obfuscated, is about transparency. And there's something about how those paintings link up sort of the idea of flatness and opacity in modernist painting, which at the same time is supposed to, in its more mystical dimensions, be a window into some theosophical place. So I thought if she's going to paint, that that was something to pursue further. Like, how far does the transparency go? I mean, the world can be transparentized all the way down, in theory, although only God would be able to see that far. But, you know, like, but it stops. It stops with just these documents. And I wonder, like, with the transparency, I mean, the politics of it are unexceptionable. And, you know, they're just like, this is awful material. But why, what happens? Why, how is it that people come to be so cruel to certain others? And what's the political mindset of the pursuit of the war on terror? And what is it that, well, how did we get to this point where, like, the highest values in American politics is to keep us safe, you know? And there's, like, so much that could be deepened in terms of what they're about and complicated that, you know, I'm left feeling less than excited.
It would seem, Marjorie, that, I mean, Joan mentioned Joan Mitchell, but the painter that they seem to me to reference in a way is Jasper Johns, because she's, but in so doing, because of the monotony and sort of dullness, but also kind of strange, misplaced painterliness, and just also the disaffect between content in terms of pictorial subject and strategy, but. Is she therefore? Is she trying to? Is she in the process of? She started by showing how remarkable this cache of documents is in the projections on public buildings. Is she now working the other way around to show how banal is it, the banality of evil that she's showing in the kind of mundane documentation?
Well, I think you're not recognizing a certain strategy that's. The idea that of making paintings that people in power buy, and then, you know, it's not one that I necessarily think is.
What is the strategy? Can you say?
Well, Thomas Lawson wrote in Last Exit Painting that the idea that a painting, which seems like a harmless thing, you could sell it to people in power, and it would sort of exist. It would be radioactive in their environment and have some kind of effect on, subversively. You know, you're like smuggling this subversive sort of thought into their homes because they didn't know it was there. Because, you know, and
all right,
and it is,
and the way those 1%ers who own Barbara Blooms are so suddenly sort of arrested in their tracks and reform their character.
Yeah, and I mean, someone like Adrian Piper has said the same thing. You know, why do I show in blue chip galleries? Even Rothko, I think, was once quoted as saying his murals for a Harvard dining room that he hoped it would make.
Seagram building.
That he hoped it would make the people there vomit. Hmm. I mean, it's an old kind of modernist. I don't know if that's what Jenny Holzer is thinking, but. There is that sort of notion of a radical use for a painting.
Do you buy that, Marjorie?
I am very impressed with Ken Johnson's narrative. And he has just upped the IQ of those paintings considerably, as far as I'm concerned. And I have several thousand words to say here, but I'll say just a few. One, in response to Ken, I think that and I was sincere in what I said, that considering a line of pursuit that she might consider as transparency and opacity on something other than, and now I'm answering David, on something other than an allegorical level. One thing I found very obvious in her show was the grayness, the dust, to this, to that, the overload in pathos that the paint was supposed to put us in mind of, and the sensitive treatment. All of it was highly scripted to enlist our sympathy. That's what I read in the intentionality of the painting and the paint handling. It was a kind of compensatory move for the harshness and the histrionics and the melodrama with which she had voiced other disaffected voices in the past.
Yeah, she's surely preaching to the choir, isn't she, Joan? I mean, is she going to raise the consciousness of anybody new with these paintings, do you think?
It's hard to tell. I wouldn't be the one who would make that kind of judgment, but I'm going to take a moment to say that I didn't mean to imply, Ken, that I found her paintings impenetrable, but rather that the surfaces are not, they don't create a depth that you can enter into like a painting. That's what I meant. The surfaces are impenetrable. But I think that's their real asset, that it's how they allow you to have those thoughts that you voiced about, you know, how do we get to this point where one human being can do something like this to another human being? How do we, as taxpayers, look at these paintings and understand our own responsibility towards what's happened? I mean, we've paid for this. So I find that really interesting. I feel like that's her most, her strongest point is her ability to get us to think about what happened and not those paintings themselves. And I'm going to disagree with you about the color. I feel like when she moves into any kind of formal territory, whether it's like devising these patterns that emerge out of filling in the white space on the documents, or her sort of spring pastel colors in those pseudo-constructivist pieces in the back, I feel like there she confuses the issue and she starts to make formal moves in what to me looks like something that has been laid out as using abstract painting, not making abstract painting.
Indeed, the pretext is a conceptual move. In other words, the paintings in the back room, which are, they're not constructivist, they're suprematist, but never mind, are downloaded from the spaces that were redacted. However, what those paintings show is how important formalism is, how important visual intelligence is. Because these works do not have them. They are indeed applied. That's the problem.
That's right. That's what John is saying, in a way.
To me, the issues of aesthetics are completely irrelevant. I mean,
that's why I would critique her when she goes into those issues by choosing those colors. Or, I mean, the paintings, I mean, you look in those paintings in the back and the surfaces are immaculate, and I mean, they have aesthetic issues in them, and I feel like that confuses it, because that's not what it's about. Or,
well, I think one of the best things you can say about Jenny Halzer is she's an irritant. It's like
she's a master on that level, yes.
So, yeah, she's preaching to the choir, but even to the choir, she's irritating.
Because choirs find it irritating to be preached to, and that's why. In a way.
Yeah, I mean, you agree with her and you feel put on the spot and you think, you know, it's like we're kind of inundated with terrible stuff going on. It's bad news every day, and what are we doing about it? And I don't know. There's something also, I guess, very idealistic about her project. Like, there's a belief in art that is, I mean, I wonder, I think to myself, does she really believe that much, that art is a place that she can really make something really deeply transformative happen, as deeply transformative as altering how we conduct war?
But it can't possibly have, I mean, if she was an idealist and we were an idealist, why would this be the strategy to have us motivated to demand change, to make pretty, but not actually pretty, paintings?
As opposed to what?
Well, as opposed to putting up a barricade. I mean, I misspoke earlier when I said Barbara Bloom. I was trying to say Barbara Kruger. Now, I'm saying that Barbara Kruger doesn't actually work when her paintings are bought by a one percenter. They don't, like, turn him or her into a great activist or anything. But I think someone like Barbara Kruger is streets ahead, no pun intended, when she puts stuff on a bus that drives through LA with those really using constructivist, not suprematist, typography, Elder Zitsky, et cetera, to make those buses into really dynamic objects that then get across ideas about reproductive control rights. And that's art activism that's actually formally very successful. So I'd say that Kruger provides the yardstick with which to give Holzer a damn good beating, because she's both formally and ideologically working, right?
I think Ken's question about whether or not those paintings aspire to actually affecting political change is really important, and I think it's really the crux of the matter when you look at Holzer's paintings, because if you attribute that to them, then you can only determine that they fail, because they're just paintings on canvas and they're not going to affect political change. But what interests me about them is how they allow the space for singular acts of resistance in terms of the single person that comes to look at them, and I think that that's a more realistic aspiration for them as works of art. And just to bring this back to something David said earlier about, well, why did she move from what seems to be much more radical media-oriented LED signs to painting? And I think for me that lies exactly in this question, is that by moving into paintings rather than media, she creates a space for reflection and thought about her subject, which I don't believe that the moving LED signs really allow for. And to me, that's a very interesting move, and it's a very interesting move in an artist at this point in time who's had such incredible success in working with media.
Yeah, the body of work that I was referring to actually specifically were the projections, not the LED displays, but the projections into, you know, when you have those same documents that she uses as her sources projected onto buildings at night. That's kind of what I meant. But
well, I mean, there's two sets of criteria. One, you're setting up, but one set of criteria is like how effective can they be as agitprop? And Barbara Kruger's a good. She's like the gold standard, I guess. And then the other one is how do they draw us into, you know, maybe they're initially irritating, but do they draw us into a contemplation, and to what end is that contemplation? You know, and to some extent, it reflects back on us, like, what, you know, I think it comes down to a state of consciousness, and I think what somehow I want to know is, like, she's putting this at us, how does she resolve it? Like, how does she see what she's doing? How does she live with herself, very successful artist with horses and you know, a nice life, and very preoccupied with this awful stuff that's going on?
you really want to, do we really want to go there? That seems, I mean, no disrespect to the art critic of the New York Times, but it seems a bit banal, a bit personal. I mean,
but what, if it's not personal, what is it? I mean,
I think you can draw it back to a generational perspective. And when you think about Holzer and also us as being part of the Vietnam generation, I think the point you make, Ken, is really important, that she throws it back on us. And we all know what went on during the Vietnam era in terms of the people's responsibility in response to the actions of their government. And to me, it's interesting to bring it back to that. I mean, if one wants to go on a personal level, I find that maybe a much more interesting question to look at where she stands in relationship to her generation than to her bank account.
Yeah.
Her bank account, yeah.
Yeah. Marjorie, just to, we should move on soon, but it's something that occurs to me with, something that's intriguing to me about Holzer's painting, these paintings. I mean, I compared them to Damien Hirst in the sense of sort of embarrassment to my mind that they're not working. But actually, conceptually, I'm also put in mind of conceptual abstraction and situations where people do make successful abstract paintings from materials that have a conceptual starting point and possibly ending point. Say, for instance, if one were to compare Jenny Holtz, this body of work by Jenny Holtzer, to the work of David Diao, would that be an instructive comparison just to show really how very different abstract painting can be when it has documentation of significance as its motif?
that's a very interesting question and an apt interlocutor, but I'm going to change the terms just slightly. If and then we can, because it bears also on Peter Fenn's work. If we change the terms to signage, we get a different printout. Art and language was very good. The collaborative conceptual group Art and Language, just to name some very deservedly celebrated attempts at introducing text and social critique into painting. We get, a different, from my point of view, a different way of looking at those works on canvas, which, when compared with signage, either are failures because they are not transparent in their message, but as Ken said, they're kind of a Trojan horse of good taste that then reveals something of that which we had not wanted to pay attention to. But when it comes to signage, there are, even within the conceptual art groups or the conceptualism, confusions about whether the message is to be clear and unambiguous, explicit, or eloquent and memorable and poetic. And I see this in a number of conceptual artists' works, including Lawrence Wiener, on whose work I've written quite a few times, and whose command of textuality is actually more hit and miss than I believe has been acknowledged. And underlying that is not gossip, but actually a genuine confusion about how the message is to be read or delivered and read. On what level is the rhetoric? So I'm not going to answer the question. I'm going to raise these as questions.
Cool.
I really dissent from the discussion of design and the relevance of that. I don't know if, sure, they could be designed and painted better, but that seems beside the point to me. I want to back to my thing about transparency. There, in these redacted things, there are three players. There's the victims of torture, there's the torturers, and there's the people who are doing the redacting, this vast sort of soulless, huge institution of people in cubicles, I guess, sort of scanning these documents and deciding what is allowed, the public is allowed to know. David Foster Wallace's last novel is about people working in an IRS facility processing income tax returns. And he thought, that boredom was maybe one of the most interesting themes to deal with. And somehow I think that is a really important aspect of, because it's something that actually we all have to do with, that we are all in some sense, maybe not all of us, maybe there are some rebels who don't fit into their proper holes, but we're all sort of drones in this system, and how sort of, not so much implicated, but sort of woven into this fabric of institutional anonymity. Anyway, that seems to me a topic I would like to ask Jenny Halzer to investigate more deeply.